huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means taking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up, an awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive, but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm currently in a beautiful setting walking down to the hotel where I'm running my Elite Speaker Bootcamp, which I run once a year. And I thought I'd have a little bit of fun and do a little bit of net leverage time and do the introduction to this episode, which I'm really excited for you. I think that, again, it's something very different. I keep disrupting the podcast, or at least doing my best to do that for you. And the chap who I'm about to interview, about 11 years ago, when I was literally just getting into proper business and had no clue, but I was persistent, I managed to get a lunch with someone who was way ahead of me. I mean, in the events business, he was pretty much the top guy. And word on the street was that he just sold his coaching academy business for many, many millions. And I thought, I need to meet this guy. And I think in the end, he just decided to entertain me for a meeting because I wouldn't leave him alone. And I went down to Putney and we sat at Carluccio's, very near to his penthouse apartment that he bought for millions of pounds. And I was like, whoa, this guy is my God. And we had a great lunch and he was really helpful. And at that time, he was one of the few people that had successfully exited the events and seminar business, because many businesses, small businesses, entrepreneur businesses, they're all based around the founder. And so without the founder, the business has no value. And many speakers, promoters, events-based businesses, the speaker, the promoter, is the main asset to the business. And I was starstruck that Jonathan had managed to exit and sell his business for, like I said, many, many millions. And I wanted to know more about it. But it was weird because for the next 10 years, I didn't really do anything with what he told me. I just built my business. Of course, I built it for the first few years around my name and my business partner, Mark Homer's name, but pretty much forgotten and ignored everything he said. And then about 5 years ago, I thought, if I want to scale Progressive Unlimited Success, I need to get my name off the business. I need people to have relationships and value to the company and to our team, our people, our trainers, and not just me. Otherwise, it has no scalability. It's only 24 hours I have in a day. And it has no saleability because people aren't gonna buy a company. And then when the founder leaves, everyone wants the founder. In that journey of 10 years, totally by accident, my business partner Mark and I had actually bought two companies. One was a personal development business, which in its best year did just about £10 million in its best year when we had it. I mean, it was doing many, 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 many millions. They were running some of the biggest events in the UK. But when the recession came, they struggled, this events promotion business. And we pretty much bought it for no money down. We paid a token sum, just really to show that there was a transaction. And really, we had the asset of a huge database, and we had some events to fulfill, about £800,000 worth. And that business grew, like I said, in its best year to do £10 million. It might do the same again, maybe more this year. I didn't even really know I did it. It was just something that happened. And also, we bought a letting agency, which had quite a few hundred units, and we did a deal, and that turned out to be very little money down as well. And so Jonathan had taught me this in our meeting where I'd bugged him 11 years ago. I completely forgot it and just went on building my business like some crazed workaholic, which of course you know from my life leverage philosophy is not how I look at business now. I then accidentally did two transactions that he'd sort of vicariously taught me back then. They've made tens of millions, they cost me virtually nothing. So why has it taken me 11 years to do an episode on this journey for you? I don't know, sometimes I'm a bit slow. So the man you're about to listen to is Jonathan Jay, who's one of the most highly regarded business owners, business buyers, business sellers in the whole country. He's a multi-millionaire. He's done many business purchases, no money down. He's turned businesses around. He's flipped businesses. He has a 4F formula. And I just think you're gonna love him. I don't wanna give anything more away in the intro. So, welcome to the episode with my good friend and business buyer, seller, flipper, legend, Jonathan Jay. Jonathan, thanks for doing the interview.
Good afternoon, hello.
You've become an expert, and you might not like me to call you that, but I think you are, certainly in the way I see you, in maximising the value of running a business, i.e. not running it. Would
yes.
that be a fair thing to
yeah,
say?
Yeah, because I think at times I'm not actually particularly good at running a business.
Right.
I'm massively organised.
You're not, or you
are? I'm not. Yeah. I'm really bad at sort of the administration side of things, yeah. and
quite your people management skills.
Well, I was about to say staff frustrate me,
yeah.
because I want things done a certain way, and that is a very limiting thing when you run a business. If you yeah. if you want everyone to be a copy of you, well, it's just going to be, first of all, you won't find those people, no. so you'll always be disappointed, and then it's not a great way to have everyone being the same person. You have yeah. a room full of clones. It just doesn't work. So I don't know. I think selling my first business so reasonably young for a reasonable amount of money
yeah.
was a bit of a wake up call that the sales process is really where you win. The day to day operations, that's not really where you make money. In fact, actually, if you work out how much time you put into your business,
yeah.
Quite often you're probably working at minimum wage
right.
If you add in all the extra hours. And my test of someone's exertion and effort into a business is if the first thing they do in the morning is look at their phone and their emails, and the last thing they do at night as they plug their phone in is look at their phone yeah. and look at their emails. So you really are operating, you know, all the waking hours, and if you divide it up on an hourly rate, it's not great. So selling a business is the windfall.
Yeah. So I'm going to explore all of this in a minute. You've
sure.
sold businesses for millions of pounds. You've bought, sold, retired, built, sold, retired,
yes.
etc. And you've got a great story. I want to pick up on something you said because I think this is really important to explore. So when we start in business, we're an entrepreneur and we have a vision of how we want things done. Most people who you hire will never do things the way you want, as you've said.
Mm-hmm.
You want to hire people like you, except people like you make the worst employees because
mm-hmm.
people like you started your business. And you think you can manage people, but you've had no experience of managing people. You're
Correct.
A shit manager of people.
Yes.
And you only learn all this 2 or 3 years into your business when it's nuts.
Absolutely. And those 2 or 3 years, typically, you don't make any money.
Right.
So not only do you have all the pain,
yeah.
you don't have any money.
Yes, yes.
So it's a double
more pain.
Yeah. So there's no reward for that huge amount of effort and commitment that you
yeah.
put in at the beginning, which is why I always advocate you should find a business that's been up and running, it's got the staff, it's burnt through all the bad hires,
yeah.
so you've got all that out of the way.
Right,
you've
yeah.
probably got a team that have been there for several years, they're stable, maybe a little bit dull from the outside because
yeah.
it all feels a little bit steady, but that's a perfect business to buy.
Yeah.
And then you can just layer in your new ideas, your fresh perspective, your new products or services, and build on a solid platform. See, a startup is being built on sand
yeah.
typically, and it's constantly shifting. You know, I speak to startups as you do all the time, and people say, well, you know, this is my product. But then you meet them a few weeks later and the product's changed slightly, so it's evolving, where if you want financial stability, you need a stability around the product or service, and buying a business gives you that.
Yeah. Now, this is a complete revelation to me. It's like a new dimension in a parallel universe, because it's not something I ever thought about. And actually, I think about 18 months ago, I got this revelation. Now, I love talking to people like you. I'm also quite happy if we have opposing views. And I some of my views oppose yours. I like running a business. I like all the juxtaposition of all the team and the stuff. I like growing it. We make a lot of money out of our business, and we have for years. But about 18 months ago, leading into last tax year, it was obvious to Mark and I we'd hit a bit of a ceiling, that growth next year was going to be hard. We were going to have to work probably twice as hard, and we might be lucky if we got 5% growth, where we'd been used to working the same and getting 50% growth. And it's like, so to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result was insanity. You know, pumping more money into your Facebook ads, trying to hire, you know, more people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we got 7% growth, but we worked a lot harder. And we thought, we can't keep doing this. It's unsustainable. And then I thought, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be an easier way. And I don't even know why this didn't occur to me. Why don't we start buying and acquiring businesses who've, you know, who may be turning over a million, much smaller than us. We'd have knowledge and skills and experience we can implement into them. And at the same time, I was listening to a podcast, and this, you know, you assume venture capitalists go into startups, but there's actually quite a lot of smart VCs. They don't go into startups. They wait until the third or fourth round of money. They wait till the startup isn't a startup, i.e. it's a real business, mm-hmm. and then they put the money in then. Mm-hmm. Because 90% of the startups have finished up and are gone. And, and it was, it's funny, you send the messages out to the universe or whatever, and that's when we started reconnecting again. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. Instead of starting it yourself, find one that has done all that hard work, and then just take it over.
Well, let's say you buy a business that has been in existence for 5 years. Let's say the first year they maybe made a loss. The owner borrowed, funded the business. So there was effectively a loss because there was a loan against the business. Year two, it started to sort of, the sales started to increase. Year three, it looked a little bit better. Maybe the loan starts being repaid. Year four, it starts to stabilize even more. And by year five, you've got something that's working, but it's not spectacular. If you buy at year five, you've just saved yourself 5 years of your life.
Yeah.
How about that? Saving 5 years of your life of trial and error. Let someone else do that. Someone who wants to do that, someone who gets excited by that, and then you come in and become the new owner. And we'll talk later if we have time about how to do that, how to structure that type of deal in a way that everyone's happy with the result.
Why would someone sell at that time? If they've done all the hard work and they've got to that breakthrough year, why would they sell?
It's because they've done 5 years of hard work, they're absolutely knackered, they're frustrated by the whole thing, they can't seem to get it to the next level, which is the phrase you hear every business owner say, I can't get it to the next level, and they've just had enough. Maybe they got to a certain point and then it started to move backwards again.
Yeah.
And it was like, I can't go through this again. Will I be here in another 5 years doing the same thing? And quite often the business owner is so frustrated, you as the buyer are solving their problem.
Right.
You are releasing them from the business.
Yeah.
You are the knight in shining armor who is helping them give them their life back.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't really think of it like that. But actually, you could have a very good business with a very good product, mm-hmm. but the lack of passion and enthusiasm and the frustration from the founder has manifested through to the team.
Correct.
Who are
absolutely
all good people, but demotivated.
Demotivated, demoralized. Yeah. You see, the thing is, you've got lots of energy, lots of enthusiasm, and you keep on going. So you as an individual, Rob, aren't representative of many business owners who really do get so frustrated. Sometimes they just want to throw in the towel. They just want to say, I've just had enough of this. If someone would just take the keys, I would walk away because my family, my life, my mental health, my frustration, my sleepless nights, it's just not worth it.
Right. Now, this is interesting. And sometimes takes me a while, but then when I see it, I see it. Liverpool played yesterday. Liverpool, my team, I support, and they lost 1-0 to Swansea, and I knew they were going to lose. And on the TV before, the pundits was talking about the new manager syndrome.
Yes.
The new manager syndrome is a team who are at the bottom, A new manager comes in, they immediately start winning games. Why do they Absolutely. Immediately start winning games? They're the same team. And Liverpool had this, and I thought, they're going to lose to Tottenham. The new manager comes in, new passion, new energy, new enthusiasm.
Great analogy.
Same people, and they start winning. They beat Liverpool, the informed team, yeah. And I knew we were going to lose. And they played really well, and they had a new tactics as well, which worked. And it just made me think, because obviously I knew we were meeting today, that's what a new set of eyes, a new owner into the business brings.
It's exactly that. And that's a great analogy. So the new owner comes in, there's almost a sense of relief that the old owner has gone. Yeah. And that's when the staff start telling you, well, yeah, Jeff was great, but... and the but is
everything.
I know the customers are asking for this product, and he refuses to stock it because he doesn't like that particular supplier. And it's like, well, if the customers want it, why aren't we selling it to the customers? Mm. And there's all these things that, because the biggest blockage in a business typically is the business owner.
Yes.
So the wonderful advantage of becoming a deal maker is, although you own the shares, you aren't the operator. The operations are done by managers, and you don't get involved in the operations. You let the managers do their job and do it day in, day out. Deal with the good stuff, deal with the bad stuff, and you limit your day-to-day involvement to a monthly management meeting or a board meeting, if you like, where you sit down and you set the goals for the next month, check on the achievement of the goals for the last month. And you know what? Business owners love the variety. So if you own 4 or 5 or 6 different business investments, you might be with this type of business, the recruitment company today, the software company tomorrow, the plumbing and electrical installation company the next day. And that variety is very, very appealing. Yeah. And you can cross-fertilize the different businesses. So if you've got a great marketing person here, now all the companies have access to a great marketing person.
Yes.
Got a great sales team over here. Well, it's unlikely the sales team are working, you know, full steam, so they can be utilized to sell this company's products over here. And those synergies and that symbiotic relationship means that all the companies, combined with the new manager syndrome, all the companies start to increase in productivity and therefore in profitability. And now you've got a group that's doing remarkably well.
Yeah, and this is a big distinction, because people mostly don't know the difference between a business operator and a business owner. And I think you've made that point. A lot of people think when you go into a business, you have to go and roll up your sleeves and do all the work. And it's very British, isn't it? We've got to work hard.
Almost, if you don't work hard, you're cheating.
Exactly.
It's like, yeah. Well, yeah, this. I mean, I had a dinner with some private equity people a little while ago. I had a business that I wanted to sell them, and they actually took me out for dinner, which was a decent sign.
Yeah.
And the four of us, so it was the three of them and me, we were sitting around the table, and as the evening went on, they were laughing about how poor they would be at actually running a business. They said, wouldn't let us anywhere near a business. We'd just mess it up. Now, at the same time, they just completed a £100 million fundraise to acquire businesses. So the city, institutional investors, had trusted them with £100 million, but they agreed between them that they would be terrible at running a business because they didn't have to run a business. Mm. They just found good people to run the business. And typically when you buy a business, the good person's there. It's usually the number two person, the right-hand person who says, look, if you just let me get on with this, Jonathan, I'll do this, 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 and this. I'll see you next month. I'll report back to you. I'll tell you what's going on. Yeah, I'm at the end of the phone if you need me, but just let me get on with implementing the plan that the previous owner held us back on.
Right, and this is, we almost feel like it's cheating. But actually, if you look at it on the reverse, if you're in the trenches, you know, and shooting at people, you don't get to see the helicopter view of the strategic map of the battlefield.
Yeah. This is classic Michael Gerber.
Right.
This is classic
E-Myth. I've interviewed him on this podcast.
Oh, did you really? If someone hasn't read a Michael Gerber book, you can summarize it in one sentence, which is work on the business rather than in the business. Yeah. And this is classic work on the business rather than in the business. And we all know, and Michael Gerber's been saying it for 25 years, work on the business rather than in the business. And that's why you have success stories versus success stories that never happened.
Yeah. And When you're on, say, a board or you're in a monthly meeting, you can just look at profit and loss and you can speak to the operations team and you know what's going on and you can make rational decisions.
Yeah.
When you're in the business and you know someone is not performing, but you got friendly with them, you used to go, because I used to go down to the gym with my staff and things like that, and I, you know, got a bit, it's good to be close to them, but I got too close to them. And then if I had to make hard decisions or pick them up on something, I couldn't do it. And so when you're stuck in, you actually can't see the wood for the trees and you can't make the right decisions. So the less involved you are, often, the more rational decisions you can make.
Here's the thing. The less emotional you are about business, the more money you will make. Now, when I say less emotional, it doesn't mean that you stop enjoying it or you don't have fun or you don't care. It just means you make decisions based upon the facts rather than the emotions. Mm. And you're right, when you get too close to your staff and someone stops performing, and typically they stop performing because they're too close to you and they feel that their job is safe and Rob won't fire me because we spend a lot of social time together, and I've had this as well. And then when you come to fire that person because you wait too long. You wait 6 months longer than you should do because you feel as though they'll be okay, that it's a good guy, he'll turn it around, he'll be all right, just going through a rough period at home, whatever it might be. And then eventually you realise that actually it's a no-go scenario and you have to fire them. They then feel incredibly aggrieved and start to take it, they take it far more personally as well. Yeah. So the less emotional you are about it, ultimately the more successful you'll be.
All right, so now let's get into this, a bit about your story. So how many businesses have you sold?
I've had three exits, but the exits have typically been a group of businesses. So I've bought and sold 16. Right. So the 16 are, it's called a roll up.
Yeah.
So I've rolled up businesses. So I roll up businesses in Marcoms, marketing communications.
Yeah.
I've rolled up businesses in education, training and education. So I've taken, just to make that very clear, I've taken several different several businesses in the same sector and put them together to make one entity.
Right.
So the three exits actually disguise all the work that's gone on behind the scenes.
And what is there a reason why you roll them up into sort of groups?
It's acquisition, growth by acquisition is the fastest way to grow.
Right.
I mean, it can take you years and years and years to get to, an early stage business, to get to £1 million of sales.
Yeah.
Or you can go and find a business that does £1 million worth of sales, meet them on Monday and own them on Friday.
Right.
And I've done that. I've met a business on a Monday afternoon, and I've owned them Friday afternoon.
Wow.
And the one I'm thinking of in particular actually did have £1 million worth of sales.
Yeah.
We had more than that at the time, but to grow by £1 million worth of sales is hard when you start to, the market matures and you can't achieve the 50% year-on-year growth. So the only way to do it at that rapid rate is via acquisition.
Yeah, which was the light bulb I got. Why do we want to keep pushing?
Yeah.
So our best year was 19 million in booked business. So turnover is normally about 60% of booked business, something like that. To grow to 23, 24 million, in fact, the year after that, we dropped a little bit. It's a lot of extra work. I only have to go and buy.
People.
Yeah. So if I buy one company that's doing 5 million or two or three companies that are doing 2 million each, hopefully with your mentorship and guidance, I achieve the same thing with much less work.
Absolutely. Much less work. You'll acquire some great people along with it. You'll get some not so great people as well.
Of course.
But you'll get some great managers.
And you can cross-purpose the skills.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You may... I mean, I was looking at... I didn't pull the deal off as it happens, but I was looking at a great telesales business that specialised in B2B.
Right.
And the thought process was behind it was that every B2B business that I buy probably has a rather lacklustre sales team. Well, I've got the sales team ready-made.
Mm.
So I think I probably... I was looking for too good a deal on that one,
right.
And it ended up being bought from the private equity firm by the managing director.
Yeah.
But the door's still open.
Right. And this is also the thing. Once you've got the system for a business, you've got the system for another business or any business, haven't you? The architecture of running a business, you could use like a blueprint. I mean, I know different sectors are different, but like a basic operational blueprint, you could turn over a business, put it into a business that is failing and turn it around.
Yeah, so you could, it could be failing because it misses one part of that blueprint, which you have elsewhere. So it could be the sales team, it could be the marketing team, it could be
culture,
customer service, some sort of quality control process, whatever it might be. You might have that missing part of the blueprint in another one of your businesses in your portfolio.
For years, people have been asking me where I buy my watches. Many of you may know I'm a watch collector, I'm a watch investor, and those as an asset class have done me very well in the last 15 years. I have never shared where I source my watches from or my watch dealer until now. My watch dealer used to be a professional footballer for Manchester United, and he formed a watch brand called Broadwalk. And he sources the higher-end brands like Rolex, Audemars Piguet, Patek Philippe and Richard Mille. I trust him, I've used him for many years, and recently we've done a partnership. Hence, I'm inviting you, if you want to start investing in watches and protect your money from the banks and inflation, to check out Broadwalk. That's Broadwalk. And the website is broadwalkgroup.com. The email is sales@broadwalkgroup.com. And please don't share this, but his number is 07496 878153. Obviously, only message him if you're serious about buying and investing in the higher-end watches. People have been asking me for years, and for the first time ever, you can get access to my watch team.
Portfolio.
Yeah. So you've acquired and rolled up 16 businesses, and you've had 3 exits. Are you allowed to say what those exits were in terms of the amount of money you received?
Yeah, the first, as I said, was more modest, but still sort of pretty damn good. It was more money than I ever made from running the business.
Yeah, but 6 figures when you're 27 years old. I mean, that could be 5 or 10 salaries.
Yeah, and this was a long time ago as well.
That's 14 million with inflation.
Let's not forget it wasn't a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
and the others have been multi millions.
Yeah,
so I'm only in, for me personally. And the people that I mentor and coach and help, I always say, get your first deal under your belt as quickly as possible. It doesn't really matter on the size. Don't worry about the size. Let's just do the deal. Mm. So you go through the process. A little bit like, what's it like? It's like if you have never dived into a swimming pool before, then you dive just off the edge, first of all. Then you go up to the first diving board. Mm. You don't go straight to the diving board, the highest level. So don't look for a multi-million revenue business for the very first deal. Don't look for a multi-million pound exit on the very first deal. Just do the deal, go through the process, learn the ropes, and then you'll start to realize what deals look like. Now, the thing is, when we do the stuff that we do, the training, there are so many different ways of doing deals. I mean, there are so many different deal structures. You never run out of things to talk about.
Yeah.
But just get the first deal under your belt. But now all I'm looking for is the multi-million pound ones. We're looking at...
Do they have to be local?
Oh, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where they are. I mean, apart from at the moment, I'm just thinking UK. I'm going to be doing this in North America and in Australia later in the year, in this year.
Yeah.
So I'll be doing things over there. But at the moment, just UK. UK based.
It doesn't have to be local, as in the town or the city.
No. We're doing a roll up in one particular sector at the moment over the next 12 to 18 months that will then lead to an AIM listing that will release. Because when you're raising money in the open markets and the public markets, you're looking for you've got to be in the tens of millions.
Yeah.
You've got to start off at sort of 30 million. Otherwise, no one's interested. You're too small to raise money.
And a way to get that size is to roll up lots of smaller companies.
Yeah, yeah. So first of all, you do your roll up. It's proof of concept, and then you get the funding to grow rapidly, and then of course you've got the liquidity because you can sell shares.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got loads of questions I want to ask
you. Yeah, I've jumped around a little bit.
That's all right. I tend to do that. So I want to just get an objection out of the way first, and I want to hear your side on this, because I have thought, and I know some people have said, is this a little bit cold? You know, are you slicing and dicing companies? You know, you're dealing with people's livelihoods. You take over a business, you get rid of all that, all those stuff, get rid of. You know, and I'm sure some people do it more unscrupulously than others. I just want to know your take on that.
Okay, I'm saving people's jobs.
Yeah.
I'm going into businesses that would have, in some cases, weeks away from closure. They should have closed weeks ago, in fact. So I'm actually saving jobs.
Right.
Now, in the process of saving jobs, yeah, you've got to trim back sometimes. Quite often it's because the business owner hasn't done the things that they should have done, that a responsible business owner hasn't done, and I've now got to take the responsibility for doing the things that they should have done. So, you know, they've let Marjorie in accounts be there for years, but she keeps getting payroll wrong, and really any other business would have fired her years ago, but they can't because there's a, it's the cousin of their brother-in-law or whatever. So I don't have that, you know. I just realized that Marjorie in accounts, I'm sorry Marjorie, but there's no longer a place for you here.
And what about if people don't like that side of business, you know, they don't want to be involved in firing people?
Oh, well, I made 70 something people redundant in a business last year, and I didn't do it. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and I haven't got the time to have 70 conversations, produce 70 letters, get 70 signatures, and shake 70 hands. You know, I do a sort of a group announcement that we're going to be going through a redundancy process, but we're going to make it clean. We're going to make it painless. Everyone's going to be paid every penny that they're owed. No one's going to be diddled. No one's going to be leave this sort of feeling raw, apart from the sort of the natural. And we're going to help you. You know, we're going to put you in touch with recruitment people, and we're going to help you find new jobs. It's not their fault.
No.
It's not their fault that the business was operated ineffectively. It's not my fault that the business was operated ineffectively, and I'm saving the jobs of the people who are going to remain. I've got a great, what I call a deal team, and my HR lady comes in. She does the whole process with the manager who's going to be running the business on a day-to-day basis. And incidentally, with those 70 redundancies, you might think, well, yeah, you know, you've had staff issues before. There's always someone who sort of, usually it's the quiet one who creates the issues afterwards and sort of feels they have some claim against the company. We only had one claim. And the claim was a phone call. And I didn't take the phone call. This conversation was relayed to me, and it was whatever the name was. And we said, well, we don't know who you are because you're not on the staff list. Who are you? We don't have you on payroll. And he said, well, I haven't started working there yet. I said, well, look, to be fair, we are actually reducing the headcount. We're not increasing it. So thank you very much for coming in for the interview. But the job isn't there that you were interviewed for. And he said, well, I've got a contract. I said, well, look, just tear. You know, they said, just tear it up. You know, it's not relevant anymore. And he said, well, no, the contract's signed. And he went to ACAS, and because he had a signed contract for a job he hadn't even done one day of yet, we had to pay him off one week's salary. Right. But that was the, so if it's done properly and professionally, you don't get the negative stuff that people think that you might get.
Right. You know what? I think there's lessons in here in running your existing business and doing, you know, deals and new businesses, because I have seen so many times people in positions that are demotivated, that have in their head moved on. You know, maybe the culture's changed, because we've had different growth spurts where the culture's changed. You know, when you have five people and you're all friends, and then when you have 20 people and you're getting an MD and they can't come in your office
anymore.
So at the
beginning, there's no processes.
Yeah.
It's chaos. It's not even organised chaos. It's just chaos. And then you try and put some organisation in. Some people don't like that.
Yeah, they
push
don't.
Back on that.
Yeah. And so I've, in nearly all the cases when people, it's been the right time to move on, it's actually been better for them. And often you think, oh, someone going in, Jonathan the hatchet in them all, getting rid of them. But actually, a lot of people, it is the best thing for them to move on. Most people who leave, it's the right thing. Otherwise, because if it wasn't right for them to leave, they'd be motivated in the job.
So let's say that with these 70 redundancies we had to make in one go, which is through a consultancy period, we followed it all by the book. I mean, everyone had access. They all potentially had access to me. It wasn't difficult to find out my email address. I didn't get one issue. I didn't get one person sounding off at me. Because, you know what? It was either right for them or... They
were gaming it a bit.
One guy sent an email around the office saying, "I don't believe I've what was the word he used? He said, I don't believe I've gotten away with it, or something like that. I don't believe I've gotten away with it for so long. I've fudged it for several years that he'd been there, and they kind of knew the game was up. And also, they knew that the business was overstaffed.
And you have a responsibility to the shareholders, if there are any, but of course, all the customers. You have a responsibility.
Absolutely.
If you can't run a solvent business, the customer loses all the money.
So actually, it was wonderful because we kept the best people and we got rid of the people who weren't responding to emails, which annoys customers no end. Yeah, they don't get a response the same day or the next day. Yeah, it's like the world's caving in. Mm. And we solved all those problems as well. We improved the business.
Yeah. Now also, I guess, because in property, essentially, the more dirty and awful and dilapidated is it inside, as long as it's structurally sound, the better deal you get. And is it like this with businesses?
Yes, it is. That's actually a good analogy that I hadn't made before. Yeah, yeah, that's it. It's the sort of the smelly house syndrome.
Yeah. You're not going to get it cheap otherwise. You're going to pay full value for it otherwise.
This is the thing. I know, you know, we both know Gerald Ratner. Mm. And you know, he was speaking at one of your events, as I was just recently. And we were chatting on the stairs. And he said, well, the wonderful thing about buying a distressed business is that you can afford businesses you'd never be able to afford otherwise.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a very smart thing to say, because that's absolutely true. You can afford businesses that you'd never would be able to afford if they were successful. Yeah. Now, one business that we took quite a long way down the path, but we didn't do the deal in the end, was a 20 million revenue commercial cleaning business.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting because I'd actually met someone who owns a commercial cleaning business just a few weeks before. So it was a lovely coincidence. Mm. And I thought, well, I can buy this off the administrators and I can sell it straight over to this other guy almost immediately, because it's £20 million worth of NHS contracts, you know, library cleaning, although there's not many libraries these days, I know, but you know, nurseries, you know, that type of commercial cleaning offices, commercial cleaning contracts. And we were offering a very, very small amount of money that we would then pay over 12 months. And it got to the point where it was going backwards and forwards with the administrator, and we thought, you know, this deal's in the bank. And we were clearly pipped at the post by someone else.
Yeah.
But it was in, you know, first of all, how long would it take you to build a £20 million commercial cleaning business to get all those local authority and government contracts? It would take a long time, right? Mm. Secondly, how long would it take you to recruit and train the 6,000 cleaning staff that were employed? A long time. Yeah. When I look at a business's accounts and I see millions of pounds of administrative expenses, I know that these days, with technology, with apps, with tracking of expense accounts via someone's app on their phone, you don't need the administrative staff that you might have needed even 5 years ago, but definitely 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So I'm thinking, okay, turning over 20 million, it's not making much of a profit. I think it was making like £20,000 profit.
Wow.
Come on, there's a couple of million of profit in there somewhere. There's 10% in there somewhere. And you know what? I'm like a dog with a bone. I can find that 10%. I can find that £2 million of profit. It's in there somewhere. It's probably in the administrative costs. It's probably lousy, lazy management that I would identify as lousy and lazy after one meeting with them. Get rid of a layer of management. It's like people say that about the NHS, don't they? So if it's the management that are causing the problems, the ineffective management. Get rid of some layers of management. Maybe put a few of my own guys in that I trust that are going to say to me, look, Jonathan, these people are a waste of space. You get rid of them. Doesn't affect the people on the ground doing the work. They just carry on doing the commercial cleaning, doing the cleaning every night when the office closes. But we could restructure it and create something really, really good. And that's what I'm looking for all the time. So if I bought a £20 million revenue commercial cleaning company that was already making 2 million EBITDA, what would I be paying for it? I'd be paying 10 million, 12 million, 14 million. I don't want to do that. I'm going to buy it for practically nothing. I'm willing to put in the effort, or rather my deal team is willing to put in the effort. Who pays them? Well, the company that we've just bought, not me, the company that we just bought.
Yeah.
And we end up with a 2 million. What do we sell it for? We sell it for 10, 12, 14 million.
Yeah. And this is going back to the house analogy. If it's not dilapidated inside, there's no uplift value.
You know, exactly.
So if you buy it, full market value.
Yeah, there's
not. You've got no uplift growth.
No, you just hope that there'll be an increase in capital.
Or just really increase. Slow growth.
You just hope that's going to happen, and you hope because the economy and the housing market's going to improve. But if you buy below market value, you can make money on day one. I mean, you mentioned assets. I don't think you said asset stripping, but you said, is this
slice and dice?
Slice and dice. Yeah, which is this asset stripping thing that people really and concerned about, because it was very much in the 80s and 90s people would asset strip. Let me give you the property analogy for that, okay? Yeah. You buy and I was looking at a business that had a property attached to it, And this property, it was actually a day nursery, a children's day nursery. So there was a day nursery, there was a four-bedroom house, and there was a three-bed flat in this very unusually constructed building. But essentially, there was three parts to it. Now, what someone with a knowledge of property might do is they might do a title split, and then they'd say, well, we can sell the house to get cash on day one. We can rent out the flat to get an income from day one, and we keep the nursery part as a separate leasehold or separate freehold, and we rent that back to ourselves, and we have an operating business in there. So is that a negative thing? Actually, that's a really clever thing.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that people say, well, with businesses, how does that work? Well, that's what we've just done. You know, that's being sold as a business that has a property, but we're now just dividing up the assets. Bought a business where we had an excess of Apple Macs, and there is a value to an Apple Mac. Obviously it decreases as the Apple Mac gets older. There's a value to the Apple Macs. So we had a guy come round, do a valuation of the Apple Macs, look at the serial numbers, and he said £40,000. So we transferred the £40,000 into our account. We said, yep, it's received, you can load your van up, thank you very much. So you can make money on day one when you buy a business. Now, we took the assets, or some of the assets, and we sold them. Yeah. But we didn't need them. What's the point? What, are you going to keep them in the cupboard, depreciating? No, you're going to sell them. Mm. It's just common sense.
Yeah. Right, so you've got this model. Find, fund, fix, flip.
Yes.
So can we spend a few minutes...
on each one.
Talking about each one. And let's get granular on this.
Okay.
So how do
and
you...
stop me if you feel I need to go into more detail.
No problem. I've done a few interviews. I will happily do that. So how do you find distressed... how do you find this type of business where you can uplift the value, you know, where there's latent potential, but you can get it cheap, maybe even free? How do you find it?
Okay, three methods.
Yeah.
The first is I talk to people. So I talk to people who then talk to other people. And because I'm typically the only person who's having this type of conversation, word gets around.
Right.
So I get people call me and say, I hear that you're looking at buying businesses.
And that works?
Absolutely.
Okay, so
absolutely.
Can I just stop you there?
Yes.
We're looking for letting agencies.
Okay.
And we're looking for online and physical events businesses, not wedding planning type businesses.
Well,
but we're looking for sort of... you know, training business like property and all that kind of stuff.
Understood.
Yeah.
Now, because you've said that to me, that's now activated my memory on those areas.
Hopefully 1.4 million other people as well.
And I know in our Facebook group, there was someone talking about letting agencies 2 or 3 days ago.
Yeah.
I can't remember whether he was buying or whether he's selling. So immediately I'm thinking that's someone you should be speaking to. There's a connection.
Yeah.
You never know, because he might be buying letting agencies, but he finds one that isn't in the right part of the country, but it's perfect for you.
Yeah.
So talking to people, just having a conversation like this, immediately there's a lead that I can think of off the top of my head.
Okay, great. Well, if anyone knows anyone in the UK, message me on Facebook.
I do it with nurseries. At every public event that I speak at, I say that I'm interested in day nurseries, and I have in my inbox this morning two people saying these are day nurseries, and one other person saying, I know of one, would you like me to contact them to see if they're still interested in selling?
Yeah.
So talking to people is number one. Number two is social media. So I don't use social media as much as I do. I use LinkedIn more than Facebook. But I would put a post on LinkedIn saying I'm interested in buying businesses. Maybe I'm very specific. So maybe I'm saying a specific type of business, or I'm more general. And typically the responses back to me aren't from my first level contacts. They're from my second level contacts, which I always think is an interesting observation. I don't know enough about LinkedIn to tell me what that means, but it's just something that I've noticed. So social media is number two. And I always insist that our deal makers open up a LinkedIn account if they don't have one, change their LinkedIn profile, and use LinkedIn to source deals.
I need to just say how I think LinkedIn is just really up their game. So I did a post 2 days ago. It got 70,000 views in a day. I did one podcast and video, and then repurposed it into LinkedIn, and it was called All This 5 a.m. Club Bollocks, and it was basically about you're not a loser if you don't get up at 5 a.m. And it got 300,000 views. And incredible. That same thing would get 20,000 views on Facebook.
That is incredible.
I don't know where this has come from. I've only got like 15,000 connections. It's not like I'm like, you know, LinkedIn's world top influencers. Something is going on in LinkedIn, which is working really well. I'm really up in my game
on that. And because it's more business related than Facebook,
we
it's
can
a great
cut
place
all
to
the
find.
Fluff.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can post
can
a business post.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Yeah, so you're reaching your market faster.
Yeah, and if you post something salesy on Facebook, oh, you're selling to me. Whereas we're in the business of selling on LinkedIn,
yeah,
aren't we?
Yeah, and it could actually be the same person who's on LinkedIn, but if they see the post on LinkedIn, it's okay.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
which is
the same
odd.
Post on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the same person reads it, and they have a different response depending on where they read it.
But I've just been blown away by the reach and the comments and the so I'm going to start doing this as well. So I'm going to start posting on LinkedIn. And then the third way.
Third one is good old fashioned direct mail. Yeah. What we call seller letters.
Yeah.
So. So I have a letter template that I use. So it's really the same letter each time. I just change the details according to the sector or the contact details in some cases. Are the responses going to come back to me? Are they going to go to a virtual assistant? Who, you know, where the response is going to go? Don't have a letterhead, just on plain A4 photocopier paper. I get my local mailboxes, etc., to photocopy it if it's a small amount, or I send it to a mailing house, a direct mail house, and I get them to do it. And I send out maybe 1,000 letters at a time, depending on how. If it's 1,000 letters, if the response is coming direct to me,
you're really making me want to do this, Jonathan.
But if I want to sort of go big with something that I've tested and I know it works, I do 10,000 letters, go back to a VA, back to a landing page, fill in a form, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And really what I'm saying is that I'm interested in your sector. I'm a private investor. It's really important. I'm not a corporate.
Yeah.
Because if it's a corporate, the pound signs start flickering in people's eyes, or they're completely turned off. Yeah. Because they can sell to you. If they sell to a corporate, they are selling out.
Right.
So selling to you is positive. Selling out has negative connotations.
Yeah.
So they're responding to you. I often tell them my motivation. So a little bit of backstory. You know, why am I writing to them? Why am I interested in this sector? I ask them to contact me. Interestingly, the last time I did this in a big way was before Christmas.
So what? That's right, two months ago.
Yeah. No, like November time.
Yeah.
On New Year's Day, I got 3 responses to the letter. Now, they hadn't just opened the letter on New Year's Day. No. New Year's Day, New Year's resolutions, saying to their partner, should we dispose of the business? Dispose is a better word than sell, by the way. Should we dispose of the business? When someone uses the word dispose, you know that they just want to get out.
Yeah.
So they respond to my letter. I then go through a process to establish whether they are a good prospect or not. And then I proceed from there.
Yeah, okay. Couple of things that this led me on. One is just a random thing. I was looking at my KPIs. So I was reading the marketing report last night. And we had one page that got 75 registrations. I can't remember the top line number of people that landed on the page. Let's say 300. Unbranded. We had another page, 25 registrations.
So you
branded as Progressive.
Oh, I see.
So you know you said unbranded letters. We all think brand. But actually, if we send out a branded letter, we can make a judgment. So it's just interesting. I remember reading that thinking, you know, often the uglier, more sort of, just less
professional
looking.
People make a judgment, they make a decision. And also, because they know who it is that sent them the letter, they can say, I can respond later because I know who it is.
Yeah.
It's XYZ company. Where if they don't know who it is, they basically say, I've got the piece of paper in my hand, I'll email them now. Mm. I'll actually use a Gmail address.
Yeah.
Right. And a mobile number.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to have an office.
So you're not overcomplicating.
You can be a deal maker. You can buy and sell businesses. You don't need an office because you can use the office of the businesses that you buy.
Right.
So you can go and sort of have a table, a desk in their office. Or I just pay £50 a month to the Institute of Directors, and I go in at 9 o'clock in the morning when it's quiet, and I have a breakfast meeting with someone, have a cup of tea with them, and for £50 a month, I can use all their facilities in Pall Mall.
Right, there you go. So do you not use brokers, or are there not websites or magazines or listings?
The only hate mail I get is from is from brokers, because I'm not a big fan of brokers, and I don't think you've heard my recording. I'll play it for you one day. I have a recording of a mystery shop that a colleague of mine did on a broker who was selling a business of mine. I paid the broker £45,000 up front. This was a boutique corporate finance house, rather than a broker is a little bit at the lower end of the market. Boutique corporate finance house. It's the same thing. They've just got nicer offices in central London.
They need to be paid for by your fees.
Well, exactly. So I'd paid 45,000 plus VAT up front for this service. And I thought, something has got not quite right here, because we're not getting, I knew that we were getting the responses because I'd helped them with their marketing, but we weren't booking in the face-to-face meetings. So I thought, something's going wrong on the phone. So I got a friend of mine to Mystery Shop, and he recorded it on an app on his phone so he could send it to me and say, look, this is what you're getting for 45,000. It was the most appalling salesmanship. There wasn't any salesmanship. It was basically like the estate agent who says, this is the kitchen, and then just stands there. This is the bathroom. Oh, thank you. Is this the bathroom? I've never seen a bathroom before. And really, is this a shower? And you have an extractor fan. Well done. You have an extractor fan in your bathroom. Those appalling estate agents, it's the same thing in business as well. And they're absolutely terrible. Now, the problem with going to a broker is that if you go to a broker and say, I want to buy a business, they will see the pound signs. And they will, they have already influenced the seller by giving the seller a false expectation of the value. Again, drawing the property parallel, you get three valuations on a property, two are about the same, the third is 100,000 more. And you're thinking, hang on, this can't be right. But
the seller wants to hear that.
But the seller wants to hear it, so they go with the one that's 100,000 more. 6 months later, they're back on the market at the more sensible valuation the two other agents got. Yeah. So the business broker inflates value. And secondly, they play the game of there's three other people interested.
Yeah.
And we know that that's difficult. My advice to people getting into buying and selling businesses is if there is a broker involved and the broker does start playing the game of there's someone else interested, I say, great. If they drop out, get in touch with me.
Yeah.
And the broker then comes off the phone, says to their manager, oh, I think I just shot myself in the foot there, because he didn't take the bait, and he didn't say, oh, right, well, I better get in there quickly. He said to me, I'll come back later if the other person drops out. Now, of course, you're in a far stronger negotiating position. When that broker phones you in 3 days' time, you know that you're the only party.
Yeah. Right. Are there any websites or sort of publications?
Oh, there's loads. Yeah, there's loads.
Any that you use?
Not that I would necessarily recommend. Yeah. No. There's lots out there. The whole problem around valuation is the business owner starts off thinking it's up here. Yeah. You start off thinking it's down here, and you meet roundabout down here.
Yeah.
Because valuation typically, unless someone's got really, really good figures, is hard to establish. The fact that they've worked in the business for 10 years and everyone loves the product or service, that doesn't really influence valuation. Yeah. Their effort doesn't influence valuation, which is why I say to business owners, if you're working in a business that you feel that every year is going to be better than the next year, but it isn't, maybe it's time to sell and start trading businesses and buying and selling businesses rather than being an operator.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I'm with you. That's great. Also, another analogy to properties, very often the best deals you get, not necessarily the highest volume, but the best, is when you go what we call direct to the vendor. So you write a little handwritten leaflet, you go to the door.
Yes, absolutely.
And they're not in any with any broker, in any website. They want discretion.
They've thought about it. Yeah. I always say, absolutely, everything's going to be treated with complete confidence. I will send you a non-disclosure agreement. So we have a template non-disclosure that we send to people. So it's all ready to go. And but what you're trying to find are the people who haven't yet got to the point of appointing the broker or the agent. But it's in their mind. It's in their mind is something they've been thinking about. And they phone you out of curiosity.
Yeah. Okay, great. So let's move on to the next F.
Fund.
The fifth F is food, because we're having dinner after this, aren't we? So, all right, so fund. How do we fund businesses? You know, let's go. And can we do it without our own money?
Yes, absolutely. You should not be spending your own money. If you're, if you think that you need lots of money in the bank to do this, no, you don't. If you think you need a perfect credit score, no, you don't. If you think that you need to go to your bank, banks hate funding business acquisitions unless you're at a certain level with a certain track record. Don't do it, because they'll want a second charge in your property and a personal guarantee.
Yeah.
You don't do it. I never let anyone sign a personal guarantee. You don't need to do... If a deal requires a personal guarantee, don't do it. Do another deal. There's plenty out there. So I always want to structure a deal where the seller is paid on what is called deferred consideration. So consideration is the jargon for the payment that the seller receives, and you have your consideration might be split into initial consideration or upfront consideration, and then deferred consideration. So it's paid over a period of time.
Yeah.
So the best deal structure is the funding is deferred over 12, 24, 36, 60 months even.
Right.
Where does that money come from? It doesn't come from your own pocket. It comes from the cash flow of the business. So your initial due diligence around the finances ensures that the company has sufficient revenue to pay the seller their deferred consideration over the agreed period, 12, 24, 36, 60 months.
Yeah, and is that the main way you structure all your deals? Are there any other structures?
Yeah, I mean, you can finance against assets. So let's say, and I have an amazing finance broker. So let's say the company has assets in terms of they have some technical equipment or some lathes or a forklift truck,
yeah,
or they have some equipment or machinery. Yeah. Their manufacturing businesses are great for this. And let's say there's a little bit of finance left on it. Then they would refinance it.
So
you pull equity out. Now, you've got a choice with what you do with that money. So with that money, so let's say you've got £100,000 worth of value of equipment. There's £20,000 worth of finance remaining on it. You refinance to £80,000. You pay off the old finance. You've got £60,000 left in the middle. You've got £60,000 that you didn't have. Now, the cash flow of the business has to support the repayments on that refinance. But of course, the finance company isn't going to give you the finance unless that's the case. Mm. So don't worry about overstretching yourself. I'd never let anyone do that. So you've got £60,000. You've got several choices. That could form part of the considerations. That could form part of the payment to do the deal. So you've got all the finance sorted. The finance occurs simultaneously with the closing of the deal. So on completion, the finance is released, transferred via the lawyers, a little bit like a mortgage, transferred via the lawyers to the seller. Alternatively, you use that cash as working capital. So it's to do the marketing that the business could never do in order to lift it up to the next level.
Yeah.
Or it's yours. It's what's called a deal fee. A deal fee is what private equity people pay themselves for the months of negotiation, backs and forwards, emails, phone calls, meetings, which of course you don't get paid for. That's just your time, and you get a deal fee. So one deal that I was doing while I was selling to private equity, they'd structured into the finance £600,000 worth of deal fees,
right?
And that was their money.
Yeah.
So that was their bonus for doing the deal. So you can pay yourself a bonus for doing the deal. So you can make money when you buy the business, not just when you sell it. So you can make money when you buy, when you run it, and when you sell it.
And how do you get a vendor of a business, an owner of a business, to agree to that?
Great question. I'll sit my team.
Hey, please,
it's a great question. Let me tell you why. Let's say, Rob, you're the frustrated business owner. Let's say it's New Year's Day. You've dug my letter out of your desk drawer.
Yeah.
You hate your business. You've been talking to your partner and you promise that this is the year you're going to walk away. You've had enough from it. You've put money in previous years. You've kind of got the money back. It's been washing its face. It's not exciting. You hate the staff. The staff hate you. You've just had enough and you want out. My letter arrives. You've saved it, or it's just arrived on the mat that morning. My letter is your exit. You're curious. You're intrigued, because a private investor implies that I can move quickly. I'm not a large corporate that moves slowly. You send me a text saying that you received my letter. I call you back. I have a conversation. We then I establish certain facts about the business. I then come along, I meet you, I maybe have a little bit of a look around the business. There's a whole process to this. It's like a scripted process. We look around the business, we have a conversation, and I tell you that I'm not Richard Branson, and the days of people just writing large checks are over. By the way, what do the finances look like? Because I've had a look, and you know, from what I can see, we're not talking about, the company isn't making very much money. Is that the case? Okay, so we reach a valuation, and there's ways of doing this. Usually it's plucking a figure out of the air on behalf of the, if the owner values it, and you reach an agreement about what the valuation is. So you've got a number,
yeah.
And you say, look, if you want to do a deal quickly, and when I say quickly, I mean like in the next 2 weeks, which means that you're released from all this stress, I take over all the issues, all the problems, then there's no way that we can go out and raise the money and get bank loans for that sort of cash. Yeah. On it. We can't do it. But what we can do is we can pay you a sum of money every month for the next 3 years. Now, you told me, Rob, that you would love to spend some time in Barbados and maybe even move out there. Well, just imagine you're on the beach, you check your online banking on your phone, and you see every single month a sum of money appear in that bank account, and you don't have to do a thing for it for the next 3 years. Would that finance your lifestyle? Yes. Would that make you feel good? Yes. Would you sleep better at night? Yes. Would you have any stress? No. You know?
So you're focusing on taking the pain away from the
seller. You get paid every month.
Yeah.
For doing nothing. Don't have to go to the office ever again. You know what? You don't even have to go to explain to the staff what's happened. One of my guys would do that. And we'll look after them, don't worry. We'll keep your name above the door.
You're a good salesman, Jonathan.
We'll keep your name above the door. We won't get rid of your brand. We might make changes in the future. Can't promise you what's around the corner, but immediately, no, don't worry. You know what? People won't even know that you've sold the business unless you want them to.
Yeah.
Doesn't that sound appealing?
Yeah.
It sounds good. You can see why a business owner would say, you know what, Jonathan? It's not as good as walking away with a huge check. But you know what? If I can't get that, this is the next best alternative.
Yeah, and the thing that you offer in exchange, because everything has to be equitable. So in exchange, you're offering discretion, important.
Yes.
You're offering, you know, maybe them to keep their importance around the business, and you're offering speed, and you're not a corporate. So you actually are offering a lot of benefits, which weigh up the
absolutely.
Fact that
we bring them in on a consultancy agreement. So if we need them, we'll pay them for consultancy. Yeah. So they can still be a consultant to the business.
Right.
So the ties aren't severed overnight.
And I guess those things could be negotiated out.
Yeah, and so the emotional thing, they don't want the stress, but in some ways they don't want to let go of their baby.
Yeah.
So we want to have that halfway house consultancy agreement solves that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to fix. How do you fix them?
Couple of ways of doing this. You increase sales and you decrease costs. surprise, surprise. So yeah. Increase sales. Most businesses don't do any marketing. I've got a marketing guy on my deal team, bringing him in, say, fix the marketing. You know, in some industries that are sort of, you know, the very unsophisticated industries, they don't even have a website that works properly.
They're very old school.
They are, absolutely. Yeah. So they put a website together 10 years ago, it's never changed, and it's got sort of out-of-date dates on it, for example. So those things are really quick and cheap and easy to fix, so we improve their online presence, which doesn't cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
The other thing is that we take out all the costs that are unnecessary, we reduce expenditure on the thing. We just apply common sense.
Yeah.
We just say, you know, why...
Reduce overhead.
Yeah. You know, you're an online business. Why are you going to meet clients? What if the clients came to us instead? I bet they'd love to see the office and to meet the team. Yeah. Let's then stop all those away days from the office where people go off to see clients, which are kind of excuse for jollies, and bring people to the office instead. So we start to reverse all the silly expenditure. We just apply common sense. And quite often what happens is that the business owner has been putting a lot of personal expenditure through the business.
This is not going to be my next question. What if they're running a lifestyle business?
And they'd forgotten that the business is paying the personal expenditure. So they'd forgotten that actually the business pays their mobile phone, pays their, pays just about everything probably. They'd forgotten it because they've been doing it for so long. They've treated it as normal. But of course, all that expenditure automatically stops. It naturally stops. And if they haven't cancelled their mobile phone contract or whatever, then you have a word and you say, look, yeah, it's still coming out of the bank account. We need to take that £100 for your mobile phone bill off of next month's deferred consideration payment.
Right.
So you have right of offset if there's yeah.
And I bet there's loads of things that business owners have.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, the business, if you didn't put that personal expenditure through, is making a profit.
Yes.
So let's say they're putting through 100,000 of personal expenditure. Well, now you've got £100,000 of profit.
Which is the equivalent of £200,000 of turnover because of all of the expenses that come off. £1 on the bottom line worth £2 or £3 on the top line.
Absolutely. So where's that £100,000 go to now? Goes to you. You're the new owner.
Yeah.
You get it, not the exiting owner.
Yeah. And then flipping them. How do you flip them?
Well, it's the selling. I mean, you know, I hear people talking about sort of buying businesses. They never talk about selling them because they never sold any. Mm. They bought them, but they never sold them. I've had some really successful exits. And I've done exits with private equity, and I've done trade exits as well.
So can you tell us about those and what the difference is?
Well, the difference is the private equity exits are all about the money. That's really all.
So you're selling to a firm of professional business buyers.
Yeah, yeah. And they're tough negotiators because they only work off the figures.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to argue with the figures, okay? Mm. Where the trade buyer, it's more of an emotional purchase.
And what's a trade buyer?
So a trade buyer would be another company. So maybe a competitor, maybe someone in a complementary business. So a trade buyer would look for synergies. They'd look for cost savings. The private equity buyer doesn't see cost savings. They might do in that they say, well, look, you've got too many staff or whatever. But a trade buyer would say, we don't need two bookkeepers. You've got a bookkeeper, we've got a bookkeeper. You don't need two receptionists because we're going to move the staff into one set of offices. So they see those synergies and they're more sensible about the value of those synergies because you're dealing with individuals who are more emotional about it than the private equity people who are hard nuts. Mm. I mean, they're tough guys.
But you've sold to both.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the tough guys, they make a lot of money. I mean, they make huge amounts of money. I mean, they make tens of millions of pounds on deals. I mean, so they're hot shots.
When you sold, am I allowed to say about the business you sold?
Which one?
The one that you were running when we met. The one.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I could say the coaching academy. For
example. So it's a very well-known business.
Yeah. So when you sold that, how long did it take, start to finish, to sell it? Because which firm did you sell it to? Which equity firm?
I sold it to a private equity firm that is not very well known. Actually, it's quite a small firm, very professional firm that's owned some quite well known brands, high street brands.
Did they own Little Chef?
They did own Little Chef. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you sold to them. How long did it take from thinking?
I'm trying to remember actually. From the process was probably over about 12 or 16 week process.
Yeah. Oh, so quite quick.
But they're fast movers. I mean, they're very professional guys, and they went from. Again, you know, like a space of probably meeting on a Monday and having an offer on the Friday.
Really?
Yeah.
And then they've got to do their diligence process and all
that. Yeah. Which is painful. I mean, it's always painful if you're on the receiving end of it.
Of course.
Which is you know, quite good if you're the person buying because the seller is hating it and wishing it all be over. Yeah. You know, they're getting itchy. And twitchy, and they're basically saying,
goes down.
It might happen, because they're emotionally invested, but you're not.
Mm.
Because if you're doing six deals at the same time, you're pretty much at the same time, you've got six deals in your pipeline at different parts of the development. You know, some you're just meeting, some you're just closing, and then the rest in between. Then you become very, very. It's like property. You do your first viewing. And you're a little bit nervous about doing a viewing. Yeah, what questions should I ask? You know, you let the estate agent lead you. Yeah. Do 20 viewings, and you're telling the estate agent their job.
Yeah. Mm. So, when you sold, did you get what you wanted money wise?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have to do a load of it in future payments, or did you get a cash lump?
No, it was a very good deal.
Yeah.
But it was a very good
amount
deal.
Of cash up front.
It was a very good deal, helped by the fact that it was a great business, very profitable business, very cash rich business, and the timing was always helpful.
Yeah.
It was just after the what was the bank? Northern Rock.
Yeah.
It was just after Northern Rock, but it was before everyone kind of realized there was a bigger problem.
But that company's still running, isn't it?
It's still doing really well. Yeah. I mean, it's a very, very successful business.
Why did you sell?
Really well managed. I decided to sell round about probably New Year's Day or the day after.
And I
was thinking, you know what? I'm ready for the next thing.
Yeah.
I couldn't see it getting any bigger than it was. But that was probably limiting that. And I was ready for a new challenge. I'd been doing it for 7 years. I had itchy feet. I was ready to move on.
And did you take some time out? Did you retire for a bit?
Oh, for like 6 weeks.
Yeah. Oh, really? I got bored.
There's only so much Judge Judy you can watch in the afternoon.
And then what? And then you decided to set up another one, or was it then when you started thinking about buying rather than?
Yeah, it was a combination of the two. Yeah, because during the course of owning the coaching academy, I bought up competitors. So I bought up, and this is what I was saying at the start, it was one exit, but there were several deals of acquisition deals that led up to that one exit.
Right, yeah, this is what we want to start doing more of in the next.
So on the surface, it looks like one, but in actual fact, there were deals that built we doubled the value of the business in 12 months with one acquisition.
Right.
And that was a distressed acquisition.
And that was a competitor.
It was a very annoying competitor because they were people who'd used to work for me.
Oh, right. So they worked for you, they left you, this happened competition, and you bought them back.
Right, yes. So I had a guy who was like my right-hand man, very sort of very convivial. He got on very well with a client, and they got their heads together, took half my staff, half my training team, set up in competition. They stole my database, and I could never prove it. I couldn't prove it, but I knew they'd stolen my database because my customers were being contacted, but it was really hard to prove. And quite frankly, I had to get over it in order just to move the business forward. And when I ended up buying the business back, one of the key trainers who was the managing director of that business was actually on holiday. And she came into the office a couple of days after I bought it. She'd been on holiday. She came in a couple of days after I bought it. And she shook my hand with a steely look in her eye, because of course she now realized her head was on the block. So I took her down to the cafe and fired her.
You sound like you really enjoyed it.
I loved every moment of it. And then I, because these were the days before cloud computing, so I got the server, unplugged the server, gave it to one of my team members who came with me, and I said, go and give him my car key. I said, lock it in the boot of my car. I took it back to the hotel that night, plugged it in to see what was on the server, and there was my database. So at last I had the proof that they'd stolen it. Of course, I owned them at that point.
Yeah.
But that doubled the value of the sale price of my business for several reasons. We'd removed a competitor from the marketplace, which is always a smart thing to do. Very smart thing to do. The second thing is we removed the competitor. We diverted all the phone lines and the web traffic to our office.
Yeah.
And the third thing, we showed the private equity people that we could grow via acquisition, which is because the question always is, so you're doing this much now, how do you get up here? Yeah. How do we get up here? We need to have a smart answer. The smart answer is typically you grow via acquisition, or you enter new markets, or you do it in America, or whatever it might be. But we could say grow via acquisition. And by the way, we just did one.
Yeah.
And we bedded it in. We integrated within a matter of weeks. And I made money on that deal as well, because Clydesdale Bank had funded a lot of the training programs for my competitor.
Right.
And they now had a liability. So two very serious guys came from, because if the training course wasn't delivered, they had money they had to give back to, I'm getting the details a little hazy because it was a long time ago, 10 years ago. But I had two very serious guys from Clydesdale Bank come in and sit with me, and they said, well, would you do the training courses for the company that you've just bought? You have no obligation to, but would you? I said, well, if you pay me.
Yeah.
So they paid me £50,000. So I made £50,000 within weeks of buying the business. That was a nice little extra I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. What a journey.
It was fun.
Yeah.
And the thing is, all of this is fun. I keep saying you've got to be, you can't be emotional about it, but it is a huge amount of fun. And the jubilation, one of the last sales that I did, we completed it. It was about 10 o'clock in the evening in a restaurant in Putney. And there were maybe eight of us having dinner. We just had a mastermind day that day. And I was sitting there as my lawyer, my co-shareholder, and my other lawyer sitting the other side of me. And eventually the word came through that everything had been sorted. I went up to the bar because it was the only hard surface that didn't have things on it. We stood at the end of the bar and I just signed everything, and then it was like, yep, we've completed. Like competing on a property.
Yeah.
All done, just done over the phone, completed. Brilliant, sold. Let's get back to the champagne.
Great. And you've done that now a few times, obviously 16 deals.
It's fun. It's exciting, it's thrilling,
yeah.
And it appeals to the entrepreneurially minded
person.
Well,
we were talking about this, weren't we, before we put the cameras on and the audio on. It's like, people love doing deals. Who doesn't love doing deals? And you know, a lot of my property following are, you know, working with you, and obviously you're helping us, working with us, mentoring us through this process. So who doesn't love doing a deal?
Doing a deal is more interesting than doing the filing, producing invoices,
yeah.
Fiddling around with Facebook ads.
You get to be creative.
Yeah, absolutely. You see the opportunity in businesses that other people don't see.
Yeah. So where can people follow you? You know, if people want to watch what you do, and are you on social media?
I dabble with social media. Yeah. Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, obviously. You can find me on LinkedIn.
So what, just Jonathan Jay and
Jonathan Jay. There's a Facebook group which is the Dealmakers Academy.
Yeah.
But that's the two. I don't tweet.
No.
That's going a bit too. And I don't Instagram either.
Right.
So yeah, LinkedIn or Dealmakers Academy on Facebook.
Yeah. Jonathan, let's go and have lunch and talk about
this
more.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Cheers.